my message this morning is entitled The Creator's Second Gift, subtitle A Tale of Two Trees. The first thing you must do when you are assigned a topic is to check out the definition of the words. What do the words mean? When I was in the seminary, I took a class in research and bibliography from the late Dr. Charles E. Winogur, the dean of the seminary. It was the only course he taught. He was a man of remarkable skill and ability and erudition and just a delightful person. He was a man of many aphorisms, and I still remember one of them. He says, all research begins with a dictionary. So, okay, what do we mean by liberty? I think a very good choice definition would be freedom to make choices that count. In slavery, of course, a slave has absolutely no control over his life, over his activities. He simply makes no decisions, no choices, that count for anything. And that has a very destructive effect upon that person's mind, character, and personality. This present quarter, we've been studying a lot in our Sabbath school lessons about the ancient children of Israel coming out of slavery. And they were in slavery for 400 years. Our African-American friends in this country come from a heritage of about 200 years of slavery at the most. Can we imagine what they would be like today if they had had to spend 400 years in slavery? It just boggles the mind, the residual impact of that catastrophe on our society today. Personal liberty, liberty of choice, is so terribly important that it was one of the very first things that God gave to his higher created beings as soon as he gave them life. No question about the first gift of the Creator. The first gift of the Creator to all creatures was the gift of life. Animals, human beings, angels, whatever. Nobody argues about the first gift. But what about the second gift? I think a case can be made this morning. A case can be made for considering the second gift to be the gift of personal liberty, the gift of freedom of choice. And this morning, in the few moments we have together, I'd like to explore with you four characteristics that come to my mind as we think about the second gift of the Creator. First of all, it is a gift of high priority with God, costly to the Godhead itself, and certainly costly to the universe. Secondly, it was a high priority gift. Third, it was a fragile gift requiring constant nurture and protection even today. And lastly, and this is where my message takes a more somber tone, the fourth characteristic is of the second gift is that it is a gift that is destined to extinction one day, perhaps not too far in the future, on planet Earth. And I'd like to examine this gift in the context of what I call a tale of two trees. First, a tree in the garden. Eden's tree of the knowledge of good and evil, where our first parents lost personal liberty, lost the freedom of choice. And secondly, a tree at Golgotha, that infamous place of the skull mentioned by all of the gospel writers, where Christ brought personal liberty and bought it back, that freedom of choice might again be the lot of the human family. A tree in Eden, the tree where it was all lost, the tree at Golgotha, the tree where it was all regained. First, this gift, this second gift, as I like to think of it, of the Creator, was a gift of high priority with God. Individual liberty, personal liberty, freedom of choice, was invented by God himself and invented before the tragic entrance of sin into our universe. He invented it back when things were still holy and clean and pretty, nothing to mar the peace and happiness of a perfect place like heaven. And God valued it so highly that he gave it to others, gave it away, at what I like to call the two creations of those special beings of higher intelligence. First creation, of course, was the creation of the angels in heaven. Those beings possessed of supernatural powers that we don't have, and a tremendous potential for doing good or doing evil. God gave them right after he gave them life, he gave them the second gift, individual, personal liberty, freedom of choice. And somewhat later, we don't know how long, at the what I call the second creation, down here on this earth, the creation of human beings, described as a little lower than the angels, and created in the image of God. And one might be tempted, if only for the moment, to think that God might just possibly have had a somewhat selfish reason behind his gift, because God wanted to be wanted. God wanted to be chosen. God wanted to be appreciated. Yes, God wanted to be recognized and worshipped for the great and wonderful and good person that he truly is. He wanted to be worshipped by angels and then by men and women voluntarily out of their own personal choice, and this could be achieved only if they had total free will, total personal liberty, total freedom of choice. He could not achieve this by creating and bringing into being a bunch of robots. Now, God could have created angels as robots. He could have created you and me as robots. Robots are incapable of making any choices, making any decisions. Robots are beings which do exactly what they are told. And I am sure that there are times when parents almost wish their children were robots. You know, no back talk from a robot, no questioning, no complaining. And you know what? You know, you don't know how lucky you are that I'm not God. Because if I had been God, I think I would have been tempted to have made robots instead of beings with free will, free choice. You see, as the theologians love to tell us with their theological terminology, God is omniscient. What does that mean? That means that God is all-knowing. God knows everything. God knows instantly everything that has ever happened in the past, everything that is happening now anywhere in the present, and God knows everything that is yet to happen in the future. And God not only knew the potential cost to himself, to all heaven, indeed the cost to the universe itself, if that gift of personal liberty, that gift of freedom of choice, ever happened to be misused by one of his created beings, God also knew that this tragedy was going to happen before it happened. Before the beings who would engage in this tragedy were even brought into being. One of the most profound things I've ever found in the writings of that remarkable lady named Ellen Hoyt. The plan of salvation was not an afterthought. What does that mean? I've read it a number of times, you've read it a number of times, and I must confess that in the past, before I got into this research, that my eye kind of glided over that. Not an afterthought. That means that God knew. God knew before he created the angels, God knew before he created Adam and Eve what was going to happen, and yet he went ahead, knowing what was going to happen, knowing what it was going to cost him. God went ahead and created them. Now we know how God created Adam and Eve, but we don't know how he created those angels. Not just exactly sure. There are at least three possibilities as I survey it. For one thing, God could have simply done as he did when he created this world and simply spoken the word, as David tells us in Psalm 33, verse 9. For he spoke and it was done, he commanded and it was steadfast. Or, second possibility, speaking after the manner of men, the Lord might have had a cosmic assembly line. When I was a young minister in Southern California, I belonged to an association of young ministers, and we occasionally took field trips for our enlarging of our understanding of things. And one day in Southgate, California, we visited a General Motors assembly plant where three different models, the makes of automobiles, Buicks, Pontiacs, and Oldsmobiles, were all made on the same assembly line. I was fascinated. Of course, there's still a little boy inside of me. And did God create the angels kind of like with an assembly line, you know, bring the head and the body and the arms and the feet and the hands, bring it all together and put it all together? I don't know. It's possible. Or, third, did he make angels In the same manner as he made Adam. Genesis 2:7 in the King James Version says that the Lord God formed man out of the dust of the ground before breathing into his nostrils the breath of life. That Hebrew word yasar, formed man. I'm told by those who are more familiar with the ancient Hebrew than am I, that this means to mold as a potter or a goldsmith might mold, or to fashion into a form corresponding in design and appearance. Or it might even mean, some people see in that Hebrew word, the idea that God carved Adam out of the ground and breathed then into his nostrils. After forming all the organs, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. Have you ever wondered what went through the mind of the Creator when he created that very first, highest, most powerful, most talented, most gifted, yes, most handsome angel whom he would name Lucifer? Can you imagine what went through the mind of the Creator as he was forming Lucifer? I don't know whether he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life like he did with Adam, but did he look at that being before he gave him the first gift? The Creator's first gift is the gift of life. Did he look into his silent, lifeless face and say, Lucifer, you're going to cause me a lot of trouble? I don't know. But I do know that God, when he created Lucifer, knew just exactly what the future held in store for him and for God himself. Did you ever wonder what went through the Creator's mind when he formed, carved Adam out of the dust of the ground? Perfect in every respect, except he didn't have life. And as he looked into that lifeless face, before breathing into his nostrils the breath of life and man became a living soul, did he look into that face and say, Adam, you're going to create a lot of problems for me too? Friends, the thing that amazes me, that absolutely astonishes me this morning, is that knowing all this, because God is omniscient, he knows everything in the future as well as the present and the past, knowing what was going to happen, he went ahead. Had I been the Creator, as I said, you don't know how lucky you are that I'm not the Creator. I think I might have taken those body parts of Lucifer and just put them to one side for a more convenient season. I'm not sure that I would have breathed into Adam's nostrils the breath of life, knowing that in so doing, I would have to pay the highest price in the universe for this creation. But knowing all of this, anyway, God went ahead and created these beings, at least mankind, in his own image. He created Lucifer, who would later rebel and reduce the population of heaven by one third. Still later, he created Adam, who would turn traitor, join the rebel Satan in fighting the government of God, and Adam and Eve together would reduce the population of Eden by 100%. But he went ahead anyway. And I have to ask the question, why? And there are several possible, legitimate, valid answers to that question. One, because personal liberty, personal freedom of choice were too important, too valuable not to be shared. But there's a deeper and perhaps even more important reason. You see, as the Apostle John tells us in that first of his three little letters at the end of the New Testament, God is love. As such, he can only accept from his creatures the service of love, no matter the cost. And that cost was pretty steep, as we'll note in a moment. Personal liberty, freedom of choice, is actually the most precious and the most costly commodity in this entire universe. Robots simply wouldn't do. Why did he do it? Well, Paul has an answer. Who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame? Moses would tell us in Deuteronomy that the Lord's portion is his people. Herein is love. Not that we love God, but that he loved us and gave his Son to be the propitiation of our sins. Second characteristic of this second gift of the Creator. It's an exceedingly costly gift. It involves what I call a tale of two trees. The tree in the garden and the tree at Golgotha. Concerning the tree in the garden, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, we already know the outcome. Satan and at least a third of all the holy angels had misused that personal liberty, that freedom of choice, prostituting it in the service of evil, and now Adam and Eve did the same thing at the tree in the garden. And modern Adams and modern Eves are still doing exactly the same thing today, misusing the power of choice, the power and freedom of choice, at the modern tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for that tree is still among us. Today it's called the Internet. It has an amazing array of good things for researchers who want useful knowledge, and I still stand amazed at what I can find on the Internet. I don't need to go to the library as often as I used to when I'm doing research. But this modern tree of knowledge of good and evil also has an amazing array of bad things covered with filth and slime by way of the knowledge of evil, too. Just 3 days ago, last Wednesday, our little local newspaper in Berkeley Springs, weekly paper, the Morgan Messenger, on page 3, devoted 1/4 of a page to the local library in Berkeley Springs, with the headline that drew the attention of every reader instantly, Porn Sites Filtered from Public Library Computers. You see, last June, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a portion of a law issued by Congress called the Children Internet Protection Act, and it requires public libraries to filter pornographic websites or lose federal government funding and telephone bill discounts. And Larry Springer, the director of our modest-sized little library in Berkeley Springs, reported that the local filtering project in Berkeley Springs had begun July 1st, less than a month after the Supreme Court upheld that part of the law. Pam Coyle, the director of Berkeley County Public Library System in Martinsburg, which oversees our library, was quoted as saying, and this is interesting, it has been found that 60% of what's on the Internet is pornographic. That's what sells. The other 40% is wonderful, great information. And friend, men and women are still making their choices for eternity at this modern tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The tree in the garden is still with us today. Then there was that other tree, the tree at Golgotha. You see, while liberty and freedom of choice were lost at the tree in the garden, when Adam and Eve listened to the very first ventriloquist act in the history of the world, Satan speaking to them through the medium of the serpent, and so at the tree in the garden, Satan had only one goal in mind, and sadly, he achieved it perfectly, totally. And so the bill, or to use the Bible term, the ransom, would have to be paid later at another tree, the tree at Golgotha. I have spent probably the largest share of my 55-year ministry in the classroom. In fact, this presents certain problems because, you know, in the classroom we have 50 minutes and the lecture is usually about 48 minutes. And I find that after 45 minutes I just subconsciously start winding down and closing things off. But most people don't want to listen to a 45-minute sermon. So I have to fight this all the time. In fact, Irene warned me today. She says, don't talk too long. So I told her that I'd share that. With my leg, maybe I won't. But the story really had appeal and interest for me. It was a story about a student in a certain university who was taking a final examination. And the teacher, and I can fully relate to this, was standing in the front of the classroom, eagle-eyed, surveying the entire classroom to make sure that nobody cheated. There are still ingenious ways of doing that, but teachers have often figured out ways to stop it. And as he was looking, scanning the faces of his students, he saw one young man over here in the corner, sitting at his desk, in agony. He was actually physically squirming in his chair. The examination paper in front of him, without a single mark on it, his face ashen. And he went over to the young man and he said, "Are you ill? What's the problem? You haven't, 10 minutes into the exam, you haven't put a word on the paper." And the young man looked up into the teacher's face and in deep anguish he said, "I've forgotten the word." And the professor blinked and he said, "I beg your pardon? I've forgotten the word." You see, what he had done in preparing for this exam, he had taken the entire content of this one semester course and reduced it to a single page of paper. Then he had boiled that down into a single paragraph. Then he boiled that down into a single sentence. And then he boiled that down into a single word. And he says, "I've forgotten the word." Now, I tell you, that's a bad spot to be in an examination. Jesus and Satan, for that's who Lucifer became. God didn't create a devil. God created a beautiful angel, and Lucifer made himself a devil. Satan and Jesus are engaged in a great cosmic war. Ellen White would title her book, "The Great Controversy Between Christ and Satan." And neither one of them ever forgot the word, because it all boils down to one thing, to one word, the word control. Jesus told his disciples of his own participation in that awful moment when, as he said, "I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven." And when Adam and Eve fell and reduced the population of Eden by 100%, they surrendered the precious gift of personal liberty, freedom of choice, at the tree in the garden, and the great war spread to this world. When Adam and Eve sinned, I call it a genetic change, I don't have a better term for it, took place in their bodies. A genetic deformity was passed on as a tragic inheritance to every single man, woman, and child of their posterity down to the present time. Conservative theologians sometimes refer to unregenerate human nature in the abstract, and they will talk about the doctrine of total depravity. But let me tell you, the Bible writers are much more succinct. Listen to Isaiah. In the very first chapter, the very first part of the very first chapter of his book, he describes a condition in which the whole head is sick, the whole heart faints. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. They have not been closed, nor bound up, nor soothed with ointment. And then two chapters from the end of his book, in chapter 64, he comes back to it. "But we are all like an unclean thing, and all our righteousnesses are like filthy rags. We fade, all fade as a leaf, and our iniquities like the wind have taken us away." Hear the testimony of David. "Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me." Now today, we use the expression "born in sin" to sometimes indicate someone who is believed to be an illegitimate child, although in reality there are no illegitimate children, there are only illegitimate parents. But that's not the thought that David is trying to present here. He's saying, "I was born with an inherent totally sinful nature, in which it was easier to go downhill than to go uphill." What Job had to say about it. "Who can bring a clean thing from an unclean?" And Jeremiah, "Can the Ethiopian change his skin? Can the leopard change his spots? Well, if he can, then may you also do good who are accustomed to do evil. And that is the condition of every one of us today. We are accustomed to do evil. And so at the tree at Golgotha, a plan of reconstruction, a plan of re-enfranchisement, if you please, was immediately set into operation. But in the Garden of Eden, it was only for those who desired it enough to obey God's instructions and to bring a lamb as a sin offering. Adam and Eve sold out. Afterwards, they had no effective, normal control of their lives. And I tell you, friends, Paul put it as succinctly as it can be put in Romans 6:16. And at this point, the King James Version does leave something to be desired. In the New King James Version, a much more accurate translation, Paul says, "Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey?" Now, the King James Version softens it unnecessarily and unrealistically, "to whom you present yourselves servants." But the Greek word is doulos, which means slave. And the New King James Version has it right. "Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slaves, whether of sin leading to death, or of obedience leading to righteousness. And neither Jesus nor Satan have forgotten the one word." The one word is control. And they are both wanting to control you. Some of you are old enough to remember the Second World War, in which they resurrected a motif from the First World War. I wasn't around for that one. Uncle Sam in his red, white, and blue and top hat and everything, pointing a finger and sternly looking into the face of the person looking at the poster, "Uncle Sam wants you." Well, dear friends, this morning, Satan wants you. Satan, Jesus told Peter, Satan has desired to have you that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you, Peter. And when you are converted, he didn't say if, he said when. Strengthen your brethren. Satan wants you. He wants me to sift us as we. But Jesus wants you and wants me. Now the methods of God and the methods of Satan in all of this are quite different. Satan's method is to control. He wants to control the will. He wants to control the conscience. But God never compels obedience. He leaves it up to us to decide which way. And there is that statement in Desire of Ages. I don't have the reference in my notes, but I can give you a very close paraphrase. There is no more conclusive evidence that a person is under the power and the control of Satan than the desire to hurt others who do not see things the way you see them. And that has serious implications for the future, as we'll notice in just a moment. Third, this second gift of the Creator is a fragile gift, a gift of great fragility, in that it requires constant nurture and protection. I was charmed in reading the prose of Theodore H. White, who is now deceased. In 1960, he wrote a book called The Making of the President 1960, and then he followed it up with about three or four more sequels in each of the next presidential campaigns, and then he brought out another book 4 years later after the next election in which he tried to summarize everything. The Making of the President 1960, you will recall that this was the first time a Roman Catholic was running for president of the United States, and it created quite a lot of interest and curiosity and in some quarters apprehension in this country. And in this book, Teddy White remarks at length about the unwillingness of even Christian men and women as late as the 17th and 18th centuries to grant civil and religious liberty, freedom of conscience, to their fellow Christians. Not only were there fratricidal wars of religion in England between Catholics and Protestants, there were wars in that country between differing Protestant sects regarding the proper manner in which English Christians should worship God. And when those Englishmen came to the New World, they came with a deep conviction. As Teddy White says, it was with this remembered bitterness that the English migrants began the building of a new society in a new world, And out of this bitterness they distilled, though not without a struggle, that first great landmark of America's civilization, that first of the creative American compromises that was to set America apart from the old world, freedom of worship, the decision that government should have no right to make inquiry into the faith of its citizens, and that the state should remain forever divorced from any religious establishment. Now listen to what he says about that. Never in civilization, since the earliest ziggurats and temples went up in prehistoric Mesopotamia, never had there been any state that left each individual to find his way to God without the guidance of the state. In retrospect, this is probably the greatest historic decision enshrined in the American Constitution. And then he goes on, each man would worship in his own manner, and the state would limit itself to the affairs of Caesar. For the Protestants who created the American state, and this is ominous too, for the Protestants who created the American state, the very antithesis of these ideas was the code of the Church of Rome, which their forefathers had repudiated in England over 200 years before. Friend, civil and religious liberties are indivisible. And whenever and wherever civil liberties erode, there is immediate consequent danger to religious liberties. And at the meetings in Williamsburg just a few days ago, I listened as speaker after speaker told of what is happening, the degeneration, the deterioration of civil liberty in these United States at the present time. For example, Dr. Robert Levy, who was a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the well-known conservative Cato Institute, it's a think tank in Washington, D.C., he gave a lecture which he entitled Freedom or Security? The Erosion of Civil Liberties in These United States. And he spoke repeatedly and with vigor and warmth about the Congressional Patriot Act passed in the wake of September 11 with much haste and very little debate, passed virtually in a state of panic, and that act today poses significant threats to civil and, by extension, religious liberties. And he pointed out how, at the present time, today, American citizens are being detained for extended periods of time by various law enforcement agencies without being charged in front of a judge for any crime and without access even to a lawyer. The right of habeas corpus, that's good old Anglo-Saxon Latin, bring the body into the court, which is at the very foundation of English common law and American constitutional law, is being denied today to citizens in this under the name and under the purpose of security. We must be secure. Well, we must be secure, but there is a price to pay for security, and that's where the debate is today. What is the nature of that price? And just this week, President Bush was going out to various places in this country and asking Congress to pass an even more stringent law than the Patriot Act, which will further subvert civil liberty in this country under the alleged necessity, if we're going to survive, well, you got to do it. Well, other people have the same thing. Did you read in this week's Time magazine a two-page essay by Nancy Gibbs that as succinctly points out the present problem in our government and in our society as anything I've read in a long time? Let me just share a few words from that essay. She said, it has become easy to wonder whether the president has done too little to protect the country or too much. On the one hand, his attorney general is making speeches in 16 states to defend the Patriot Act because Congress is now trying to repeal it. And more than 150 cities and towns have passed resolutions saying they don't like to be spied on. But on the other hand, you can read the latest reports about flimsy border security and lethal germs and how easy a man took a 4-inch knife on board a United Airlines flight just last June. And you wish, on the other hand, that even more money, more muscle, more ingenuity were going into this fight. Last week's U.S. News and World Report carried on the back page, as it always does each week, a thoughtful editorial by the editor-in-chief of that magazine, Mortimer Zuckerman. He entitled his editorial, "Facing the Threat Among Us." And he reminds us that, and I'm quoting, "The tragedy is the very science and technology that have enriched civilized life have also put more potent tools in the hands of evildoers." And then he quotes a recent book which was entitled "Our Final Hour." The title was not chosen carelessly. The book was written by Sir Martin Rees, the Royal Astronomer of the United Kingdom, who Zuckerman says is one of the true wise men of science today. And Sir Martin warns how terror and error might well threaten our future in this century. And what was his conclusion? This is sobering. "The odds are no better than 50-50, Sir Martin says, that our present civilization on Earth will survive to the end of the present century." No better than 50-50 that we're going to make it through the present century. Of course, the questions raise delicate issues: the rights of unimpeded science, the rights of privacy, and now we must set against that the very right to survive. Sobering. The fourth and last characteristic of this second gift of the Creator: it is a gift that is destined to extinction in America and in the world, according to our understanding of the Bible prophecies of Revelation chapter 13 and chapter 14. For if our interpretation is correct, and I tell you folks, the longer I live, the more I believe in the veracity of our understanding of those chapters, because things have been happening, falling into line one after another. If our understanding is correct, the United States government will one day, and it may not be in the far distant future either, will one day pass a national law requiring Sunday observance of all men and women, all boys and girls. The initial penalty for ones not possessing the mark of the beast in the forehead or in the right hand will be economic boycott, and it will be very inconvenient when you cannot buy or sell unless you have the mark of the beast in the forehead or in the right hand. The ultimate penalty will be capital punishment, verses 15 and 17 of Revelation 13. Now, friends, the issue then will not be merely an issue of one day of the week against another, whether Sunday or Saturday are the right days on which to worship God. I still have in my file a printed copy of a sermon transcript by the late George Vandeman. In the early 1950s, a half a century ago, he held an evangelistic campaign in the Sligo Church, and he entitled one of his messages very aptly. He spoke of the symbol of liberty, loyalty, and love. Well, let me just share one more thing. Dr. Hodges, Clarence E. Hodges, vice president of our church, North American Division, and also in charge of the religious liberty work within that territory. And at this meeting, he echoed the sentiments of Sir Winston Churchill when he said ominously, "When we sacrifice freedom for security, we wind up with neither." And then he just gave one example. He spoke of the CDC. Now, that's the Center for Disease Control of the U.S. Public Health Service. The CDC has announced that if there is an outbreak of smallpox, all public meetings will be outlawed. And Dr. Hodges goes on to say that will represent a significant erosion of religious liberty, as church, mosque, and synagogue doors will be locked. And then, ominously, he said, if minority religions get blamed for majority problems, minority religions can lose their freedoms in the interest of security. If majority religions become convinced that their way of worship is required of all minority religions in order for all to enjoy the enriched quality of life, then minority religions, in the interest of securing that quality of life, could be outlawed, could be persecuted, could be denied all freedoms, even the freedom to buy and sell. Seven times in Revelation chapter 2 and Revelation chapter 3, the angel speaks to God's churches through the aged apostle on the island of Patmos, and he says, let him who has an ear hear what the Holy Spirit says to the churches. My brother and sister this morning, may God help us to see and to understand clearly the prophetic handwriting that is clearly on the wall today. We were told over a century ago that the agencies of evil are combining their forces and consolidating. They are strengthening for the last great crisis. Great changes are to take place in our world, and the final movements will be rapid ones. The challenging call of Joshua of old rings out across the land today to every Bible-believing Christian who senses the current signs of the times. Choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. My prayer is that your response will be that of Joshua. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Let us pray. And now unto him who is able to keep you from falling and to present you faultless before the presence of God with joy and happiness, to the only wise God our Father, be glory and majesty, dominion and power, now and evermore, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. To order CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls, please dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? Our email address is info@americancassette.org. We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and financial support are important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.